everybody. It's Candace from Autism One Radio. Today, my guest is Christina Hildebrand. Hi, Christina.
Hi, Candace. How are you?
Good. Christina's from A Voice for Choice, and she was at the Capitol just the other day with SB 276. Can you explain 276 to us, Christina, and then will you go into what happened over there?
Sure. So SB 276 is a bill that was introduced by Senator Pan. It was a spot bill and then changed to include the wording that is currently in there, or it's been amended, but currently in there. It is a bill that expands on SB 277, and when I say expands on, makes it worse, not better. And it is specific to the medical exemption. Mm-hmm. So during SB 277, and for those who are not aware of 277, SB 277 removed the personal belief exemption from the vaccine mandate and only allowed a medical exemption. So our vaccination rates as a result of that in California, actually it's mostly the people who are conditional vaccines, so people who were not fully vaccinated that were getting vaccinated that have actually contributed to this. But our vaccination rate has gone up to about 98.1%. So we have increased vaccinations rates since SB 277. But in doing so, our medical exemption, which at the time of SB 277 was 0.2%, has increased to 0.7%. Now, the opposition will say it's tripled, and that is terrible. But realistically, going from 0.2% to 0.7% is not statistically significant. And so we expected the medical exemptions to rise because people that were using the personal belief exemption were using the personal belief exemption because it was easier to get and less hassle to get than a medical exemption. And doctors at the time weren't writing medical exemptions really for the most part. They relied on a parent to just sign the personal belief exemption because it was just easier. So what we've seen is this increase, and Senator Pan is saying that there is an outbreak or an epidemic of doctors selling, basically doctor shopping, doctors selling medical exemptions that are fake, and doctors mm-hmm. and people sort of shopping mm-hmm. for the doctor that will write them a medical exemption, even if it doesn't really apply to them. The issue there is, so what SB 276 would do is it would do a variety of things. One of the things it would do is it would remove the doctor-patient relationship. So that relationship you have with your doctor that has given a medical exemption would no longer be there. They have done your medical history, your family history, possibly genetics, looked at your child physically, all of those things to determine whether they should get a medical exemption. It would remove that because it would put the county health department, so the public health department, mm-hmm. in charge of determining whether your child should have a medical exemption or not. So somebody arbitrary that never met your child, never looked at, anything. I mean, they will have some backup records from the doctor, but basically would be deciding whether that medical exemption was viable or not.
But I feel that that would be a violation of my privacy.
Well, so it would, but it doesn't violate HIPAA, which is HIPAA is the Privacy Act that keeps your doctor, doctor-patient conversations and information between you and your doctor. It wouldn't be violating that because in order to get the medical exemption, you as a parent would have to sign a piece of paper saying, I agree for my medical records to be given from, my doctor to the health department. Similar to, if you go and see a specialist, they will say, well, can you have your doctor send your medical records over to me? And you have to sign a piece of paper saying, yes, I agree for my medical records to be sent from, A to B. So it does, but it does legally. So personally, it does. Legally, it does not. The second thing that SB 276 does is it removes the ability for medical exemption to be based on your family history, on genetics, mm-hmm. on anything mm-hmm. other than the contraindications. So the contraindications for vaccines are mostly just anaphylaxis. In other words, you've stopped breathing because you've had an adverse reaction to the vaccine. Encephalopathy, so you've had brain swelling to the vaccine. Or, for example, if you're immunocompromised, then you can't get the live vaccine, so the MMR and the chickenpox. Those are the three situations. The other thing to note is it is just for specific vaccines. So if you had anaphylaxis, so you had an allergic reaction to a vaccine, it is only that one vaccine. that you would be exempt from. So you could go ahead and get all the rest of the vaccines, which, you know, if you know anything mm-hmm. about vaccines, they all have similar ingredients, or most of them have similar ingredients. And likely if you've had an anaphylaxis, an allergic reaction to something, it's not likely to be the virus that you've had an allergic reaction to, but something in that vaccine. And so, but the CDC contraindications say it's only that one vaccine that you can not have again. You can have the rest of them. And so it's a very, very narrow. It's probably 0.01% of people that fall into that medical exemption profile. So everybody else, so, you know, a family that has a child who has continual seizures diagnosed after vaccination, yes, it was the vaccinations that did it. That child, that parent, that family under 27, under SB 277 could get a medical exemption for their sibling. So if you are a family that has that situation, it is so extremely unlikely that you're going to vaccinate your other children, because the likelihood of that happening to your other children is higher. And, you know, would you ever do that again? No. So under SB 277, that was one of the things we fought for during SB 277 and was granted, was that the medical exemption would be expanded to include family history. So if a parent had a severe reaction to vaccines, if a sibling had a severe reaction to vaccines, if your family has a history of autoimmune disorders, you know, there's a whole gamut of things that the doctors have been using. It has to do with the latest research in vaccines and vaccine reactions. But that will be completely taken away, and it will just be on the contraindications. So even if you were paralyzed, for example, after a vaccination, you wouldn't be able to have a medical exemption to further vaccinations. The answer is go vaccinate. Or, you know, there is still the option of homeschooling. So those are two things. The other thing that it would create is a database. So anybody who has a medical exemption, in other words, who isn't fully vaccinated, would go into a database. And that database would be used for identification during a epidemic, so during an outbreak, or probably a preeminent threat to an outbreak. You don't know how they're going to use it, but basically would identify those people who aren't fully vaccinated to that particular disease, and would mean that they could identify you and do whatever they wanted to you. So it may be quarantine, it may be fine you, it may be force you to get vaccinated, all of those things that we're seeing happening in other states.
Show up at your door, and that's why we have our Second Amendment. I'm sorry, I'm a constitutionalist.
I know you are.
I believe in the autonomy of my body.
Yep.
And
that's not what this bill is all about. Is what they
but the
say.
Database. So they're going to have a complete record of.
Mm-hmm.
That's like
record of people that are fully vaccinated, which is scary. You know, to me, there shouldn't be. You know, you shouldn't be in a database like that. I understand that they want to identify you, but. You know, and I'm sure we know there are other ways. We haven't had these databases before, and we've been able to mitigate the spread of disease. So those are the three main mm-hmm. things that this bill does. It doesn't really, you know, the funny thing is it doesn't actually address what Penn is trying to get to, which is this doctor shopping. So let's go into that a little bit. So he says it's either doctor shopping or unscrupulous doctors writing fake medical exemptions. Those are two phrases that he uses. Both of them basically imply that there are doctors out there that are, you know, saying, give me $500 and I'll just write you a medical exemption. At Voice for Truth Advocacy works closely with the doctors and doctors' groups, and I can guarantee you that I don't know one single doctor that is doing that, because the consequences are that they're being brought in front of the medical board. So even if you're doing your due diligence and you're only writing medical exemptions to those people that you have, you know, done all the testing on, done a physical, looked at their medical records, looked at their family history, all of those, that's what most of the doctors do. Even those doctors are being brought in front of the medical board and questioned about their medical exemptions. And so we have no evidence. We've sent PRO Public Record Act requests to the California Medical Board to understand how many doctors they have under investigation, how many doctors have been found, you know, guilty, so to speak. And what we found is that there are 153 that have been investigated or are currently under investigation. And there have been zero doctors that have been brought up because of fraudulent medical exemptions. Now, the one that Bob, that Senator Pan quotes is Bob Sears, Dr. Bob Sears, and he is on probation, but he is on probation for writing a medical opinion for a court case, not for a medical exemption. And even then, it was because he didn't keep diligent enough records. So it was his record keeping that he is on probation for, not for the content of that medical exemption. The other thing that Pan says, or Senator Pan says, is that he, you know, that basically the medical board cannot do their job because the parents in these cases where, you know, they've had complaints against these doctors, the parents in these cases will not hand over the medical records. Well, that's also not really true. So the parents may not want to hand over the medical records, but what ends up happening then in the process, as it does when any doctor is investigated for any reason, is the California Medical Board subpoenas those records from the doctor's office. And a subpoena, just like in any court case, you can't get around that. They say we need the records, and you have to hand over the records. So the fact that they're saying that, you know, and Senator Pan said, you know, there's insufficient evidence. That's why half of these got denied or got basically thrown out. Half of these investigations got thrown out. When the California Medical Board says there's insufficient evidence, it means there's not enough evidence to, you know, I'm going to use the word convict, but whatever the right word is, you know, to bring this doctor in front of the medical board and have their case heard. That insufficient evidence isn't that the doctor, that they couldn't get the records. It's that there isn't, the doctor didn't do anything wrong. There's insufficient evidence that they did something wrong. So that's the fake medical exemption piece of it. The doctor shopping piece of it. So what that implies is that, you know, a parent goes to their doctor and says, I would like you to do a medical exemption evaluation. And the doctor doesn't give them the answer that they want, i.e. says, no, I'm not going to do that, or no, I'm not going to give your child a medical exemption. And they go find a doctor that is willing to do a medical exemption evaluation. Now, why does that happen? It could happen for the reason Senator Pan is saying, where, you know, there are doctors that are selling these, you know, advertising them on their website. But really what's happening is, if you look at the doctors in practice, most of them, many of them, are incentivized by the insurance companies to give vaccinations, and they just flat out don't give medical exemptions. They won't do the evaluation. They either throw you out because you're not fully vaccinated and you're questioning, you know, you say that your kid had an adverse reaction and they don't want that person in their practice because they don't make money off them, or they are, we have many doctors that we know of that actually think that they're the patient should have a medical exemption, but they're too scared of being brought in front of the medical board if they write that medical exemption because they don't have the money. So if you get brought in front of the medical board, it costs tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars to defend yourself. And so there are many doctors that are like, I can't afford that. I don't want to be brought in front of the medical board. So they say, I'm not writing any medical exemptions. I'm not going to do any evaluation. But, you know, Dr. So-and-so down the street, I know, will do the medical exemption. And so they go to those doctors who are doing the who are willing to do and brave enough to do the medical exemption. The other thing with the doctors that are doing the medical exemption evaluations is, you know, they are our experts. There are experts who have done thousands of hours of research on vaccines and vaccine reactions and are looking at the most up-to-date research. So the research that's coming out this year, that's coming out last year, the majority of pediatricians in the state of California, in the United States, are not doing that research. It takes, I think it was in the New England Medical Journal or the British Medical Journal, one of the two, and it said that it takes 17 years for research to be published to get into a doctor's office. So most pediatricians, you can assume, are using data that is 17 years old. Some of them may have done a bit more recent research. But these doctors that are providing medical exemption evaluations are the doctors, are our experts. They're the experts in this field. They're the doctors that have done the most recent research. And similar to any other condition, you know, if you were in your pediatrician's office and your child, you know, had, I don't know, a swollen eye, let's say, and the pediatrician said, oh, you know, don't worry about it. It'll go away. It'll go away. Just, you know, just leave it and it'll go away. If you're not happy with that answer, what would you do? You would go and get a second opinion from an eye expert. And that's what parents are doing. And yes, there are very few doctors writing many exemptions because
A, doctor observed, and B, these are the experts in their field. So I would say to Penn, you know, Senator Penn, that show me. He hasn't been able to show us one single doctor that is doing either of those things. And yes, there are doctors that advertise that they will do medical exemption evaluation. They do that because they're the experts in their field, just like an eye doctor who's an expert in their field would advertise that they see patients for eye issues.
And maybe the doctor that would write a medical exemption is a doctor that, you know, has regard for full informed consent, maybe.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, I think those doctors, they're more researched, they're more knowledgeable on this issue for all issues, you know, for everything to do with vaccines and vaccine injuries. So, you know, I think it is. So my question, you know, is this bill, and we had the hearing, and I can get into the hearing, but this bill, the way it's written, does not address that issue. It doesn't address the issue that Senator Penn has, and it will harm thousands of kids because they will no longer be able to get medical exemptions. And those medical exemptions are based on the doctor's discretion, and it's based on things that include things like genetics and family history, which have to be included in a evaluation of whether a vaccine can cause risk. Everybody can agree that vaccines there is a risk and they are not 100% safe. So if vaccines are not 100% safe and we don't have any criteria, any solid agreed upon, you know, medical criteria that the majority of people agree upon of how you can identify those children that are at risk. So we have some genetics, we have various ways of probably saying, yes, you have a higher risk of having a vaccine reaction. But we don't have anything that's black and white that says you will have a reaction and you will not have a reaction, right? We don't have anything that says that. So you have to take the risk factors, all the risk factors involved, into consideration. And that's what these doctors do and are doing.
So would SB 276 override anything in SB 277, for example? I know that the IEP kids are exempt. They don't have to be vaccinated, and they don't need a medical exemption.
Yep.
But that wouldn't have anything to do with IEP. Is that right?
Correct. It wouldn't have anything to do with IEPs, and it wouldn't have anything to do with homeschoolers.
Okay,
so it's
great.
Just truly these medical exemptions that are the target.
Okay, so it doesn't affect college kids.
Does not affect college kids, although, you know, the for example, the UC system has adopted the same, they're the only ones in the state thus far that have adopted the same rigorousness as SB 277.
Okay, so it's basically preschool to 12th grade.
To 12th grade, yeah.
And we talked about this a little bit. I think it's important that we talk about it now, but age of compulsory education is to the 12th grade, isn't that right? You can't just drop
it is,
out.
Yeah. And it starts, right? It starts at 6 years old. So kindergarten here in California is not compulsory. They keep trying to pass that in the legislature, but it hasn't passed yet. So kindergarten is not compulsory. Age six is when you have, I mean, if you're six and you go into kindergarten, then obviously, but age six is when compulsory education starts, usually first grade. And then it is till 12th grade.
But even if you're in daycare, you pretty much have to have all these vaccines.
Yeah, if you're in daycare, then you have to, this SB 277 applies to daycare.
Okay, so that's settled.
Yeah.
Now, can you tell me, okay, so this went through which committee on, Wednesday?
Yeah, it was heard on Wednesday in the Senate Health Committee. We assumed it was going to pass, which it did, because Senator Penn is the chair of that committee. And this is where, you know, I can get into a little bit of the bias of our legislative system in
California. Conflict of interest.
Yeah. I mean, it was assigned to only one committee. We felt it should have been assigned to either the business and we felt it should have been assigned to the business and professions. It is a doctor. It relates to doctors. It should have been assigned to that committee as well. It was not assigned to that committee. It was only assigned to the health committee. And Senator Penn chairs the health committee. So, you know, that to me, that's a conflict of interest. So,
and of
this
course,
is,
it's going to pass.
This is all, yeah, this is all legal. There's nothing that says this shouldn't, you know, there's nothing wrong with this in our system except for the underlying bias of this system towards a legislature getting their bill passed.
So please tell me that it has to go through several more committees before it's passed.
So it does on the Assembly side. It does not on the Senate side. So it goes through, well, it'll go through the Appropriations Committee, but we don't have we can't give testimony there. We can write letters, but we cannot. It's not a same committee hearing, so to speak. And then it will go to the Senate floor also, where we do not have where we do not have the chance as public to voice our questions.
But we can send letters right away.
Letters, yes. I'll get into sort of action items of what should happen. Let's go over the hearing. So the hearing, Senator Pan chairs the committee, which means that if anybody wants to get a bill passed in that committee by, you know, the other committee members, they basically have to vote for his bills, because otherwise he can stop any bill being heard in that committee that he wants to in the future. It also, you know, if you watch the committee hearing, it is set up also completely biased. So Senator Pan gets to give an opening statement. That statement can be as long as he wants it to be. I think it was probably about 20 minutes. I didn't record it. He then had 6 minutes of testimony on his side. He had three people testifying. We then had 6 minutes. We had two doctors up there testifying. And then Senator Pan, then we heard the Me Toos, and I'll go into that. That's public comment time. And then after that, questions can be asked from the committee. And the committee can ask, what I didn't realize and I found out this time, that the committee can ask any question they want. Anybody on the committee can ask any question they want. And they can direct it at a certain person, either somebody who testified in opposition or in support, or to the author. But what I didn't realize, and I realized this week because it happened, was that if the author chooses to answer the question, they get priority over answering the question, and the person the question was directed at does not get to answer the question. So what you have is Senator Pan, and then once all the questions are done, Senator Pan can have preemptively asked some of the other, his colleagues that he knows are on his side, to ask questions for him. So he's not allowed to ask any questions, but he can plant questions. And we could do the same if we had a friendly on there and we worked with some of the senators to see if they would ask questions for us. And then finally, once all the questions have been answered, the back and forth, then Pan gets to give a closing argument, which again was, I think, somewhere between 10, 15, 20 minutes. And so what happens is that, you know, of the time that was testimony or questions and answers or opening and closing, Senator Pan basically spoke for 90% of that time. And so it's really not, you know, to me, if it's a fair democratic process, you would have 50-50, 50% the opposition and 50% the support. And you would not be able to, you know, it wouldn't be, you know, they will argue, well, you got 6 minutes. They got 6 minutes of testimony. But realistically, it was absolutely not, you know, if you take the whole amount of time, you know, it was certainly not anywhere close to 50-50. It was more like 90%, 10%. And so it's the way our legislative process works. It is fine. It is the way it's done. And so, you know, it's more gripe about our legislative process than this particular bill. But it's exacerbated on a bill that is a contested bill, because you can see it even more. The other thing is that, you know, their side, there was a CMA, the California Medical Association, had a lobby day that day, coincidentally, and that was planned well in advance. It wasn't, I don't think it was planned, you know, I don't think this hearing was planned to be on this date, but maybe it was. So they had a whole bunch of CMA people that were there for the lobby day, mostly students, come in and give their I support, I support, I support. And then we had, and I haven't done a count, but I would estimate we had over 1,000 people, probably around 1,200 people that came out and opposed the bill and said, you know, I oppose this bill, I oppose this bill. And it was amazing. I mean, it took hours for everybody to give their opposition. But realistically, you know, did that impact the legislatures? It impacted them because it took up their time, although only three legislators actually sat around. The chair, the vice chair who was, well, Senator Pan had to, the vice chair who was, you know, chairing the meeting at that point,
and two others, I think one or two others, stayed for the whole thing. But, you know, most of the other legislators left and went and did their own business during that time, came back for the question and answer piece of it. But, it, you know, again, it is just, it is not set up for opposition to have any say in this. So we you know, the hearing happened, the votes came in. We were extremely surprised and I have to say disappointed by Senator Leyva's support of the bill. She had very much stood out and opposed SB 277 for reasons that it would be harmful to single parents and lower income parents that wouldn't be able to homeschool their kids. You know, SB 276 just adds to that. It exacerbates that problem. However, Senator Pan has also made this partly a measles epidemic issue, and I can understand, you know, the senators are sitting on, well, you know, if I have schools that have a higher level of, or a lower, higher level of medical exemptions, i.e. not fully vaccinated children, could, you know, my Senate district could be a tinder, to quote Pan, be a tinderbox for the measles epidemic. And, you know, it is a public health fear is basically what it is. Do I think it is accurate? I don't think it is accurate. You know, do I think our children that have medical exemptions, that are medically fragile children, I mean, they're the people that we were trying to protect or that the legislature was trying to protect during SB 277. These kids that are medically, have medical issues that could result in them having an adverse reaction to a vaccine or a worse adverse reaction to a vaccine. So we should protect those children. And, you know, Senator Grove, who is a Republican, asked a very poignant question of why does the woman on the pro side, why does her child who has kidney issues and cannot be vaccinated for the live vaccines, why does her child trump a child like Otto, who was up there, Otto Coleman, who has transverse myelitis and is paralyzed from the waist down because of a vaccine, I mean, known, you know, diagnosed as a vaccine reaction. Why does her child trump Otto in this situation? You know, Otto would not be able to have a medical exemption in this situation, but yet he was paralyzed by a vaccine. You know, would you, if you take the word vaccine out, take any other medication, if you got paralyzed or your child got paralyzed from that medication, would anybody say, oh, go ahead and take the medication again? No way. You know, it's because it's the word vaccine that's in there that it's fine and it's okay, but it's not okay. So, you know, and I think that's a poignant question. Where is the line drawn of somebody who is born with a autoimmune disorder or, you know, is immune suppressed or an issue that makes them immune suppressed? Why does that child trump somebody who's had a vaccine adverse reaction, severe adverse reaction, that you're telling them they have to go get vaccinated in order to go to school or miss out on school? So those are kind of the key issues. The measles issue, I mean, we are seeing these measles. I mean, it's so hyped in the media. It's so out of control, you know, mass hysteria on this measles. There are 38 cases of measles in California. If we look at the number of whooping cough cases, the number of mumps cases, they outrun these measles cases by far nationally. But because those vaccines are failing, it's not brought to the media.
That Pan's been working on writing this bill for a while. It's not like there was the epidemic, and then Pan decided, you know, he has to get on this to write this bill to save everybody.
Right.
You know, we know what his intentions are. That's just crazy. So it does have to go through two more committees.
It has to go through, so on the Senate side, it goes through appropriations, which is the fiscal impact of it. It goes through the Senate floor. If it makes it through the Senate floor, and it makes it through appropriations, then it goes to the Assembly side. Once it goes to the Assembly side, it will be referred to at least one committee. It'll be referred.
Right. Last time it was supposed to go to two committees and didn't get. Didn't go to the second committee. SB 277 went right through.
Right. So it will definitely go to the Health Committee. We will argue that it also needs to go to the Privacy Committee or the Education Committee. I mean, there are a bunch of different committees that it could go to.
But do we really have a say? who did that?
We can argue for it. You know, ultimately it is up to the Rules Committee where they want to put it. We argued for it in the Senate side. I personally think that they only sent it to one because Pan introduced this bill so late that if it had been assigned to two committees, he wouldn't have been able to get this bill to pass out of the Senate side in time. So it would have been stalled before it happened. Now, do I think that's right? Do I think that it shouldn't have been given its correct committee hearings? No, I don't. But I work in this building and I get to have more say than the people who are, you know, calling in and are either organizations.
You know, the people that I represent.
Right.
Oh, boy. But were there a lot of people, like students, medical students there? Were they the people supporting the bill, or were there a lot of parents supporting the bill?
No parents. There were no parents supporting the bill.
Were the lobbyists lining the front row of the hearing room, like, you know, their VIP?
There weren't that many lobbyists there from their side. If you watch the hearing, there were a number of doctors on their side and there were a number of medical students on their side. There were a couple of parents, but they were with Vaccinate California, which is the sponsor of the bill. There were no parents just coming out and giving their support, you know, as we had. There was no sort of grassroots there, let's put it that way. And the reason, you know, I'm curious to see when it does go to the next committee, how many of their side show up. Because, as I said, it was the California Medical Association lobby day. So they had 300 doctors on site lobbying on other bills. I mean, the CMA lobbies on, you know, they have a huge number of bills that they put forward every year. And so those people were told, 1:30, come and give your support for this bill. And so they showed up for this bill. The other thing, I mean, it represented the CMA. So the CMA has 40,000 medical professionals as their members. That's about a quarter of all medical professionals in California. And the majority of them are students or people that have just come out of medical school or residency. And it's, you know, if you think back, most people, when they first get their first job, whatever it's in, you become a member of whatever association is your, you know, your field association, you know, whatever you're doing, whatever work you're doing, it's kind of the, oh, I need to be a member of that association. And then you pay your dues for, you know, 2-3 years and you go, oh, well, this is kind of a waste of money. It doesn't really do me. They don't do anything for me. And I'm just paying money to, you know, have it on my CV or something like that. And once you've got your own sort of reputation or your own, you know, you've worked up in wherever, that's when you don't need them anymore. And so that's the CMA very much is, and I don't remember, but I think it's about 50% are either medical students, fellows, residents, you know, in not long-time doctors.
Well, thank you for being there. And I know that A Voice for Choice has hired lobbyists to talk with legislators.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a couple people that have some questions. What is the difference between A Voice for Choice and A Voice for Choice Advocacy?
Okay, so there are two different organizations. I'm the president of both. A Voice for Choice is our 501c3, which means it's tax deductible and it is focused on education. So what we do out of there is really educate people and answer questions. And when we go to, you know, shows or expos, conferences, that kind of thing, it's really the education of people. The 501c4, which is A Voice for Choice Advocacy, is our advocacy side. So that is what allows me to go to Sacramento to hire lobbyists to really be part of the legislative process. And you have to keep those separate. So while I'm the president of both of them, we have different board members on each. And I very specifically put a hat on, like in this conversation prior, you know, I had my advocacy hat on. I have to keep that very separate, and we keep what we do separate in those two as well.
Now, Christina, what's your skin in the game? Why is this so important to you?
So I have two completely unvaccinated children. They both have medical exemptions based on family history and genetics. and they, you know, I want to keep my kids safe. They, you know, it's interesting because our doctors are, have all, while they don't know very much about vaccinations, all the doctors and specialists that we've seen, even at places like Stanford, have said that they have a higher risk. The question is, what is that higher risk? What risk is there? And so I want to keep my kids in school. You know, my older daughter is going to high school. There's no way I would be able to homeschool her, both from a place that, you know, I have a full-time job outside of this. But I also, you know, when I look at her course schedule and she's going into, you know, honors physics and honors math and honors English, I look at it and I go, holy crap, there's no way I could teach you that. So, you know, homeschooling isn't really an option. But I also see, you know, I've been exposed especially over the last 4 years, to so many children who are vaccine injured, and the difference between vaccine injured children, or, you know, those that are vaccinated, and those who are unvaccinated. And I just, you know, to me, our mission is at A Voice for Choice and A Voice for Choice Advocacy is to educate and advocate for informed choice and transparency of anything that goes in your body. So it's much more than vaccines. It's food, air, water, pharmaceuticals, anything that you kind of can take into your body, whether it's on your skin or actually ingesting it or injecting it. Any of those things, we want you to know what's in them and for you to make the decision of whether you want to put that in your body. So let's take vaccines. You know, if you come to me and say, I've researched them completely, like I've completely done all my research, and I want to vaccinate my child, I'm not going to say don't vaccinate your child. I just want you to have all the information and make that conscious decision. Same thing with the food that you put in your body. You know, if you don't want to eat organic, that's your choice. But know what's in that food. Or if you want to eat McDonald's every day, that is your choice. I'm not going to stop you from doing that, but know what's in it. Know what is going, you know, what it's made of and what chemicals are in it and how it's been raised and farmed. So, you know, those are the pieces there. But I just, the other piece is I see the influence, and this comes from the lobbying side of things, I see the influence of the pharmaceutical industry and the big ag industry in our legislature. And I just, it is sickening, honestly, the amount of money that they pour in to get their bills passed is just sickening. And we need more people to stand up against that legislation because it's just, you know, it just is overriding.
Well, let me just say, I, for one, being the parent of a vaccine-injured child, yep. I am very grateful that you are on the front lines fighting for my family.
Thank you.
I can't go out there all the time, and mm-hmm. I want you to know that I am so grateful.
You're so welcome. And I, you know, I get that quite a bit. I think, you know, I feel privileged because I do have two healthy kids, and you know, thankfully, you know, people like you made me aware, or you know, doctors and Dr. Tenpenny, and you know, I mean, it was a while ago that I did all I started doing my research, but you know, I'm thankful for those people who have spoken out who have vaccine injured children, because if it weren't for you guys, you know, I wouldn't have known to ask the question, and so to me. I have the time and I have the ability to do it. And so I do it. I feel that, you know, it's the least I could do. I wanted to go back to the lobbying question. So we did hire lobbyists, and that's something that I don't know if that's on your questions to ask me, but the lobbyists are a controversial issue because people say, you know, but why spend all of that money? They're expensive. Why spend that money on lobbyists? Why not spend it on other things? And what I realized in SB 277 was that we have an amazing grassroots. I mean, we saw that again this last Wednesday, the number of people that showed up. But we don't have a continual presence in Sacramento, you know, from a grassroots perspective. We come, we show up on a day, and then we go away. And, during SB 277, I realized that. And I also realized that that building, and this I've learned so much more over the past, three, four years. I mean, I go up to Sacramento probably once a month if we don't have a bill going on, or if we have a bill going on, it's once a week often. But I realized that that building works around legislators, staffers, and lobbyists. And those are the people that are heard in that building because they're there every day and because they have relationships. It's all about relationships. And while
grassroots can have relationships with their legislators, it's not the same as somebody who's there every day that pops in your office and says, oh, hi, I'm so-and-so, you know, let's talk about this bill.
Yeah, so, they're working together. They work together. They see each other every day.
Exactly.
It's
and
like my relationship with my husband as opposed to my relationship with a neighbor, you know.
And or your what? You know, if you go to work every day, those are the people that you're talking to. You're not talking to the business that sits next door to yours. You know, you're working with those people. And it's not only, you know, I will also say it's not only just work. You know, these people live in Sacramento. They have kids that go to the same school. They have, you know, they go to events. They, you know, all sorts, you know, sporting events and other things together. And so it's not only, you know, it's who they work with. And so what I realized over the past years, and we had, you know, two lobbyists lined up right from the get-go on this, but, you know, I said, you know, if this bill is coming, or if we proactively can get a bill out there, we have to hire lobbyists. We have to have them on staff. We have to do it. And it's because they have those relationships. And the other thing is, you know, they're going in on, you know, they're working on different clients, different bills. So they're going into legislative offices, talking with the actual legislators on one thing, and then they can go, oh, and by the way, you know, I just wanted to talk to you about this bill as well. And they can have that, they have that relationship. They can do that. Whereas, you know, if I call up, even my own senator that I, you know, I have a cell phone number, I can talk to him if I want to, if it's an emergency. I don't do that unless it's an emergency. But, you know, even my own senator, I call up and I say I'd like a meeting, and they say, oh, yes, you need to meet with a staffer first, and then you need to meet, then you can meet with him. And, you know, I go through the process because I know that's the process, but I can't just walk in and say, oh, hi, you know, I want to talk to Senator Hill right now kind of thing. And so I think it's, you know, it's very, very different, and that's how it works. If it were up to me, do I think it's completely wrong? Yes, I absolutely think that the thousands, however many people that showed up on Wednesday, they should completely trump every lobbyist because there were that many people there. It's not how that works. It's not how that building works. And so, you know, we, as long as that's the game, we have to play that game. And so we've had some amazing funders come forward and support us in hiring lobbyists. As I said, they're not inexpensive, and this is a hard fight. Like, it's not going to be an easy fight. But we have three amazing lobbyists on board that are doing great, amazing work. So, you know, it is, while I don't believe lobbyists should be the answer, it's the answer that we have to deal with right now.
Right. It just doesn't seem fair since we're the taxpayer and they are representing us.
Yep. I mean, is any of the way the system works fair? Absolutely not. Like,
no,
I could,
it's so one-sided. It's easy to see.
I could write a whole paper about, I could write a whole paper on, like, the how wrong the system is.
Well, you know, Christina, are there any lawsuits going on over SB 277 right now?
There are none that I know of. There is, you know, we were sort of the last one, our lawsuit.
Yeah, we bombed because we ran out of money on the RICO case.
Yeah. I think it's a money thing. And I also just, you know, right now the legal system is not much better than the legislative system. There is this, you know, it really comes down to a public health fear. Like, our case was...
Well, wait a minute now. Let's not overlook the corruption that goes on.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. I mean, no. Yeah. No. But the, you know, our case was a constitutional case. Like, you could have been as pro-vaccine as you wanted. It was a purely constitutional argument, and we set it up in that way so that it didn't matter what judges we got. If you read it and you understood the Constitution and you understood how it should work, our arguments would have held. But we got into oral arguments, and one of the judges basically was just like, well, what about polio? You know, polio, when I, you know, you're too young, son, to our lawyer, to remember polio. And polio happened, you know, our lawyer's just like, polio has nothing to do with our argument. And he's like, well, but what are you asking for? Polio to come back? You know, and that was the answer. That's what guided it, guided their decision. And it was kind of like, come on, that has nothing to, it literally had nothing to do with our argument. You could be completely pro-vaccine, wanting everybody to get polio vaccine,
and still have said this is unconstitutional. And that's where it comes down to a public health issue. And that we saw that in the hearing. You know, it came down to fear of the measles were you know, part of why this vote went through.
Well, I'm going to need to go soon, but first I want you to tell us how we can take action. And I want you to tell us when the next hearing is. And I just wanted to say really quickly that I've been involved in Cali Summit, and Christina has been there, and we do have a relationship. Christina puts together the Live Aware conference, and she has speakers that talk about all kinds of environmental toxins, not just vaccines, but she's very active in looking out for us, the public. I've seen many people make documentaries on the clothes that are, what was that documentary I saw where the man loses his wife, he takes his daughter shopping, they get some pajamas, and they have this chemical smell.
Right.
And so he spends, you know, his next few years or more, you know, trying to get to the bottom of what this chemical is that they're putting into our environment that we are not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thank you for that, Christina, because I know that you could tell me what's going on. So are there any other programs that A Voice for Choice has that we could become involved with?
So that's the main one. We do have another one that is called Glyphosate-Free Schools, and so we're working to get glyphosate out of school properties and both in food and in the environment. So
that's awesome.
But other than that, those are the two key ones. And I would say go ahead. Sorry.
You also have a packet that we could ask you for. A Voice for Choice would send us a packet with, you know, some guidelines or whatever to speak to our legislators, get our foot in the door, questions to ask, things to discuss.
So that is all of it is at A Voice for Choice Advocacy. It's /FB-276, or if you go to issues, or I think it's issues at the top, it says, and then it'll say 276 legislation. We have everything there. I would say that from an action item perspective, number one, find out who your senator and your assembly member is. If you don't know who they are, call them up and get an appointment with them. You'll probably be told you have to have an appointment with the staffer. That's fine. You want to insist on an appointment with the actual legislator. If you can't get that, then you want to find out when they have their community meetings. So most legislators have either coffee mornings or town halls or some events that they're public events where they will be. And the key there is to go, and if they have an open question time, to raise your hand and ask the questions that you have. The other piece of it is, though, at the end of those, you can go up to them and, you know, the request there is, can I have a meeting with you? I really would like to meet with you on blank, blank, blank. And usually they don't say yes, and they don't say no in that environment because they don't want to say no in front of other people. So it really get a meeting and in the next 2 weeks with your senator, because this will go to the Senate floor by the middle of May. And so we need you to go reach out to your senator, talk to them about the issue. We have, as I said, there's a flyer on A Voice for Choice Advocacy of the key talking points. We also ask that there's a petition on that website as well. So it's a petition against both SB 276 and AB 262, which we didn't talk about, but we can talk about a different time. But a petition, and what we're looking to get is as many. I mean, we would love to be at 100,000 signatures on that saying no on SB 276. So that we can take that to the legislature and we can say, look, there are 1,500 people that showed up here, but here's all the people that are against this who can't show up because many people have vaccine-injured children that can't show up or they work. You know, the people who can show up are a much smaller you know, minority of the actual people out there. So those are the two key things that we ask people to do. Right now, going in the meeting with your legislature is probably the most important, but also signing the petition to, and then showing up at, you know, the next two, the appropriations and the Senate floor, we don't have, you can show up, absolutely, and if you have the time, please do show up. But once it goes into the Assembly, to show up at the Assembly hearings.
So we should meet with our senator, and mm-hmm. we should meet with our assembly person as well, start
yes.
building relationships with all of these people.
Yes, yes.
Okay, now, Christina, is there any way that we could write bills to combat Dr. Pan?
So the tough thing there is, and we absolutely have been working towards that, and we want to get there. The tough thing is, because Senator Pan is the head of the Health Committee, most of the bills that we have would go through the Health Committee. And in the Senate side, so in the Assembly, the committees have to hear the bill. So regardless of who brings it, regardless of what it is, they have to actually hear the bill. In the Senate side of things, they don't actually even have to hear the bill. They can just say, I don't want to hear this bill. And so it can never see the light of day. So as long as Senator Pan is the chair of the Health Committee, it really doesn't make sense for us to bring a bill up, because basically what will happen is it won't see the light of day, and the proponents, you know, the people on that side will say, huh, see, another loss for the anti-vax, in quotes, side of things. You know, they haven't been able to do anything, get anything going. And so we just don't think it's the right time to do that. Are we building, I mean, that's part of building these relationships. So, you know, when you go meet with your senator, when you go to their coffee mornings, when you bring them, you know, organic muffins or whatever you want to bring them to their office, to meet their staff, to know their staff, to be, you know, to have a relationship. Those relationships aren't just for fighting bills. They're not just for being against bills. Therefore, when we have a bill that we want to move forward, that they can go in, that you can go in and you can say, look, we have this bill that we're supporting and we really want your support on it, and that you've got that relationship already, because we have to have those relationships in order to get anywhere.
All right. Well, Christina, I think we covered everything.
Thank you.
When do we have our next hearing?
So as I said, appropriations will be probably the beginning of May, first or second week in May, but we won't be able to give testimony there. And then it will go to the Senate floor towards the end of May. It has to be out of the Senate by May 31st, and we have to and we don't have a chance to have public comment there. We can have public, you know, then it goes to the Assembly. So the next hearing that we have to show up for is probably in June, but doesn't mean to say if you feel like going to Sacramento before then, I'm there most Mondays or Tuesdays or both, and if you're up there, I'm happy to meet you there. And you know, if you haven't been to Sacramento before, you're not confident in lobbying, I'm happy to sort of show you around the building and
well,
help you
great.
Become more comfortable. So anybody, that offer is open to anyone that wants it.
Now, how do we reach you with questions or comments or just
sure?
To...
So, a Voice for Choice advocacy. My email is info@avoiceforchoiceadvocacy or info.org. Make sure you do .org, not .com, or info or Christina@avoiceforchoice.org. We also have a Facebook page and we have a Twitter account, so both of those work too.
And if you don't mind, Christina, I think what we should do is get together and do another interview, and we can talk about A Voice for Choice, and we can go over your website and get people in there so
yeah.
that they can have the tools that they need to help.
Yeah.
So I think that'd be great. And I want to thank you for your time today. I was very upset
thank
yesterday.
You.
I couldn't sleep at all. And I was busy, you know, schmoozing
yep.
Trump, so he'd help us out. And in the meantime, I found out that somebody said that SB 276 passed. I'm like, what? You know,
yep.
And then I didn't sleep at all, but I didn't realize it had to go through a few more committees.
Yes.
So...
Yep. It's got life left, and it hopefully will kill it before it gets all the way to the governor.
Thank you so much for all you do, Christina. Have a great
Thank
day.
Thank you. Sorry.
Be well.
Thanks, Candace.
Bye-bye.